And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. John Wells here with Lynn Ware Peake. Well, that was a fascinating discussion, and I'm looking forward
women
to the Nobel discussion as well. I believe that, he's with us now. Okay. So we were just speaking with Anna Yen, who has written Sophia of Silicon Valley. And as we know, the Nobel Prize is not only the most prestigious award in science, it's also humanity's most esteemed accolade, its most sacred cow. But winning that prize can take on a competition that trumps the collaboration that is so badly needed, especially among others to advance their work. Our next guest, Brian Keating, has written a book about the Nobel Prize and the dark side. Keating is a professor of physics at the University of California, San Diego. And we're going to hear from him about his coveted prize, about this coveted prize that began in 1895 when Alfred Nobel, the inventor of dynamite, created this prize as part of his last will and testament that would recognize the greatest benefits to mankind. Brian Keating, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hi, guys. It's great to be with you.
Yeah, good to have you here as well. Maybe you can start by telling us how the Merchant of Death decided that he was going to do some good.
Yeah, it was really a public relations coup, which is ironic considering all the bad publicity the Nobel Prize is receiving today. But Alfred Nobel was wandering around his beloved adopted hometown of Paris, France, one day, and he saw a headline, and as you said, it said, "The Merchant of Death is dead." Alfred Nobel, the man who had been responsible for more deaths than anyone else in human history in 1880, up to 1888 at least, was dead. And of course, he was reading it. So, you know, as the Mark Twain line goes, the reports of his demise were over-exaggerated. and he read the below the headline, which seemed to be gleefully celebrating his death, and found out it was his older brother, Ludwig, who had died, obviously not him. But that was kind of a gift, you know, that like George Bailey or Ebenezer Scrooge or one of these Christmas tale type people receive, which is that you get a glimpse as to how the world will not only react to your death, but also will go on without you. And I think it was a gift to Alfred Nobel that he took very seriously. And he had no children, no spouse. And he decided he would forever redeem the Nobel name by endowing prizes for literature, peace, chemistry, medicine, and my beloved field of physics. And these prizes have kind of taken on a life of their own in the preceding 122 years since he wrote down his last will and testament. And my book is an attempt to kind of deconstruct what's gone on, what's gone wrong with the prize. That's told through somebody who came very close to winning it himself, along with his team members, and then saw it slip away, and then a year later was asked to nominate the next year's winners of the Nobel Prize. So that was kind of bittersweet, having lost it once, and then really resolving that perhaps the prize itself needs to be lost.
Yeah, and he must have been profoundly moved when he read his own obituary, and to see, you know, maybe it was his own self-reflection, you know, that he could look at himself and maybe never thought of himself that way before. And when he saw the words, it probably had a large impact on him as well.
I think it did, you know, and in many cultures, respecting the last wishes of the dead is sort of one of the most sacred things you can do. And in this case, you know, he really entrusted the executors of his will to follow through with these wishes to, as in his words, the discoveries and inventions that scientists and others and then peacemakers would come upon would be, quote, for the betterment of all mankind. And so his will was sort of what we call an ethical will. It had elements of, you know, financial distribution, but also of an everlasting legacy. And it was clear that was paramount in his mind. I'll point out he didn't give the money away while he was alive, and he did give twice as much money to his nephews as he did to his nieces. But besides the point, he actually had an altruistic, you know, noble, L-E, vision for what would come of his legacy.
So fascinating. So talk a little bit about the history of the Nobel Prize, some of the awards. I mean, each year when we hear the announcement of who has won the Nobel Prize, we consider them, you know, the greatest thinkers, the greatest doers and innovators of their time. And yet there's a little bit of a dark side throughout the history. And this one time it was, well, it was a different time, but the prize was given to, I suppose it was the creator of the lobotomy, and it talked about the therapeutic value of the lobotomy.
That's right, yeah. So there have been many instances where not only the Nobel Prize is used to celebrate past accomplishments, but it's used to both settle scientific debates for all time and also to popularize treatments and procedures in the medical and physiology field, or to advance causes of, in the Peace Prize and the Economics Prize, which is a prize that Alfred never authorized, and his great-grandnephew sued to have his name removed because it was being used for political purposes. So, you know, throughout the years, I mean, I couldn't have, you know, asked for sort of better publicity surrounding the Nobel Prize than we've had in the last week alone, where, you know, Donald Trump has been bandied about as a nominated, literally nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize. And, of course, then there's this huge scandal brewing. You know, I thought last year's selection of Bob Dylan was, you know, a unique and controversial. And I didn't think it would get much more controversial than that. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, this year they've canceled the Nobel Prize due to a sex abuse scandal that took down not the man, you know, who was really responsible for committing these alleged crimes against young women that sought influence, that he sought to influence, but the woman who was the general secretary, the director of the Nobel Prizes in literature. She lost her job, you know, so it's, the woman took the fall for the misdeeds of a man. And I think, you know, it's kind of emblematic. So this year the Nobel Prize in Literature has been canceled by the King of Sweden's direct orders. So the preconception that the Nobel Prize represents humanity's best and brightest has been largely true in many of the selections. But, you know, it's also the case that the systemic failings of the committee and the sort of failure to live up to what Alfred Nobel wanted is really responsible for them trying to achieve a greater influence, the committee themselves. And I think that's been emblematic in many of these bad, blundered prizes that have been given out throughout the history of the Nobel Prizes.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Professor Brian Keating. He's a professor of physics at the University of California, San Diego. He's written a book called Losing the Nobel Prize, a story of cosmology, ambition, and the perils of science's highest honor. And wondering, Brian, if you can take us through this story of cosmology, because this is a whole other story within your story. Someone called this one of the greatest stories told in cosmology.
Oh, yes, that's a great honor to hear that. So the story of our universe is really a mystery story, a mystery novel, if you like, that we're placed, you know, not really in media race, you know, not really in the middle of the story. I mean, we really are there at the very beginning. And the question that's really roiling and boiling in my field of cosmology today is our universe the only universe? So I take the reader through a history of cosmology starting in the 1600s when Galileo became the first, you know, scientist to use a telescope, to be an astronomer using a telescope to apply the heavens to understand where does humanity fit in the cosmic grand design. And then he, of course, displaced the Earth from being the central fixed point of the universe around which everything else rotated. And instead, we had motivation that the sun was the center of the universe for the first time using his data. So I take the reader through many different episodes leading up to this very moment where we now know that the Earth is not the center of the solar system. The solar system is not the center of the galaxy. The galaxy isn't the center of the universe. And our next question that we're debating very hotly to this very day is whether our universe is the center of the multiverse. So not only are there multiples of galaxies, stars, planets, and people, but there's also potentially, in the most dominant theory of cosmology, the potential for multiple universes. So in those, some of those other infinite number of universes, I'm interviewing you guys. and you guys are here, and you guys are the professors. And in some of those, you know, universes, the sun is red, and we go the opposite direction about it. And so it's quite fascinating to think about these things because they have direct impact on the way that we visualize our importance in the universe and in the grand scheme of physics and nature itself, and whether or not we are the only universe, or we're just one of an infinite number, has dramatic ramifications from everything from philosophy to physics to theology.
If we could just go back to Galileo just for a moment, I learned in your book that his friend Paolo Sarpi had actually told him about the device, and what I found fascinating was that he never saw the device. Just by hearing about it from his friend, he went and constructed his own. And was he the first person? I mean, there were spy glasses out there to be able to look at a field of an army and to try to understand what the troop strength might be or what the strategy was going on. Was he the first person to point it towards the heavens?
Yeah, he's the first person to really do that in a scientific method. There were reports that there was a British, a lens maker, spectacle maker who looked at the moon but didn't really make too much of it. But so, yes, Galileo was really, a phenomenal intellect because, as you say, he never saw the device. He never saw a copy of it. And it's, relatively complex. Nowadays, you think of it as simple. You can go online and buy one of these for $29, as I recommend all your listeners do, because it's really the telescope is the cheapest form of time travel that you could possibly have. And it might do as it did for me as a 13-year-old boy, spark my interest in a subject that became my life's passion, which is astronomy. And so all that for, less than some of the app purchases on your phone, right? So I think it's really spectacular that he was able to do it. Of course, as I say in the book, he really committed a slight form of plagiarism because he never attributed, the knowledge that he had heard of it, to this friend of his, and then of course to the Dutchman Hans Lippershey, who had invented the device or is credited with inventing the device itself. So he just said, some Dutchman told my friend Paolo about it, and then the rest is history.
Well,
and
he had a fascinating. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just saying we academics, often channel our inner Galileos because we fail to cite, the preceding sources often.
Well, he was also a capitalist. He had a lot of stuff to pay for, and he was trying to get his market share up.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, in modern, your previous guest was talking about Silicon Valley. I mean, the universe is the ultimate startup, right? The Big Bang, and what he was trying to do, you couldn't really rattle off a telescope every, second like Apple makes iPhones, but you could make books. And that's what Galileo did. So he trafficked in the currency of intellectual ideas through his famous book, Sidereus Nuncius, The Starry Messenger.
Yeah, and just a final note about Galileo. 450 years ago, or maybe 475 years ago, he builds this device. He points it towards the heavens. He's looking at Jupiter. He's taking copious notes on what these structures look like that end up being moons around Jupiter and how they're moving to come up with this whole thing that the sun is not the center of the universe. And you have this little note you throw out in the book, which I really got a kick out of, but it's also sad. And that's on the 450th anniversary of his death, 25% of Americans and 33% of Europeans still do not know that the sun is not the center of the universe.
Yeah, it's really frustrating. I gave that statistic once when I was speaking in Italy, and I just gave them the American statistic first. 25% of Americans don't know the sun is the center of the solar system. And they all laughed, stupid American, whatever. I can't do a good Italian. And I said, well, don't get too cocky, guys, because 33% of you guys don't know it either.
Good.
And then they said, no, that cannot be true.
The homeland. I was in Galileo's house when I said it. It was so funny.
Oh, that's funny. Okay, so let's weave these two stories together, the one of cosmology and the project that took you to the place of nearly winning the Nobel Prize, you and your team, and that narrow miss that you referred to earlier.
Yeah, so it was very, you know, kind of bittersweet to go through it because, you know, we had been told all along that if we measured the signal that the telescope that I designed was meant to measure, that we would not only reveal the, you know, universe's birth pangs of the Big Bang itself, the inflationary, expansive explosion of the universe, but we would also assuredly win a Nobel Prize. And when you have those kinds of emotions, you know, big science triumphs and big payoffs in terms of career skyrocketing and tangible benefits from winning humanity's highest accolade. I mean, I call it science's greatest honor, but it's really humanity's greatest honor and the Nobel Prize, that is. I don't think there's another award that really comes close. But, you know, the story of how we came so close to winning it and then lost it and we were really undone by the same phenomena that ended up being part of Galileo's undoing, you know, where he really was fighting tooth and nail that the Earth was not the center of the solar system. And, of course, his, you know, his funding agency, the Medici family, and then later on his, you know, the government, the Vatican, basically came down on him and caused him to, you know, basically say that his ideas were false and incorrect. But he kept fighting for them, you know, to be accepted. And we also, you know, sort of fell victim to that in a sense, because we were really trying to get our ideas accepted, because, you know, a lot of the tangible benefit that we would receive from it, you know, besides revealing the instant the universe came into existence, would be this ultimate accolade. And I think it caused us to commit the same sin that Galileo and many astronomers have fallen victim to. It's called confirmation bias. When you set out to measure something, you tend to sometimes exclude things that contradict your hypothesis. Mm-hmm. And scientists are just like normal people. We're biased and we have failings and peccadilloes, and people have a stereotype that we're not like normal human beings, but we really are.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. Another failure that you talk about in your book, and something that we have noted over the years that we have that we've done this show, Cool Science Radio, is that the greatest advancements in science tend to revolve around the great collaboration and scientists no longer working in silos. But what you're saying, what you've said in your book, is that this fierce competition for the Nobel Prize has to do a lot with the lack of collaboration and that competition, and maybe hiding your results from someone else that could be helping to bring your science into a greater innovation and advancement.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I think that's one of the original sins of the Nobel Prize, is that it only really recognizes the way that science, the paradigm of science in the late 1800s, and that's not surprising because that's when it was written down, and that's who the first winners were. And now it's morphed, as science has morphed, the Nobel Prize hasn't. I mean, they allow three people to win it now. But in reality, last year's prize in physics, my subject, was won by three people, but they were, you know, responsible for a team of 1,050 other people. And I think it's kind of demeaning to the contributions of those people. And I've talked to many of them, and they feel, you know, they feel left out, they feel overshadowed. And because this prize has become this exalted idol within society and certainly within science. But I don't think it's fair. I think looking at the way, say, Hollywood, I mean, we scientists look down on Hollywood, and it's not a good thing, I think, because in Hollywood, you know, I don't know too many actors and actresses that say, oh, my whole goal is to win an Oscar. But you better believe that the movie studios want them to win an Oscar, and they want the films to win Best Film and Director, and et cetera. And so the funding agencies for films are analogous to the funding agencies for scientists, namely the National Science Foundation, NASA, et cetera, and our universities. They want us to win the Nobel Prize as well. And so they put a tremendous amount of pressure on young scientists in particular. And then when you find that the funnel is capped at three people at most, it really undermines the collaborative spirit. And I think it's doing a great deal of damage to science's integrity. And I propose in the book concrete ways that the Nobel Committee could reform these prizes and do so before it's too late, before all of them get canceled.
And it's a brave new world. I mean, you want to honor his last will and testament, but we need to be current with what's going on. And we also need to anticipate what's going to happen in the next 20 or 30 years. I mean,
yeah,
from these standalone islands.
I think if you look at Alfred Nobel, I kind of look at him as sort of like the founding fathers of the Constitution of the United States. and that it was meant to be a living document. You know, it's kind of ironic for a will, you know, to be a, sure. a living document, but there's no reason that it couldn't be. And they've changed it many times to suit their needs. I'm saying they, the Nobel Committee, the Swedish Royal Academy of Sciences, they've changed it throughout the years. They've given it to people for the, you know, for their own purposes. And I think they can change it for the good. And they so far have refused to, although I've heard from members of the committee and the Academy that they agree with virtually everything I'm saying, but they're not very sanguine that the changes I propose will be adopted. But that's okay. Change can come slowly, and it's okay as long as it does.
Yeah, and as Lynn said, we spend time on our show talking about science and technology today and where it's going, but we also talk about the history of it. And the history is very clear that you have these standalone islands where you might have an astrophysicist working alone, a paleontologist working alone, and then you see, you know, they're including chemists and biologists and particle physicists, and they're using people in the same discipline. They're using people in other disparate disciplines, and they're moving them together. And then the question that I have for the future is, and when's this going to happen, with artificial intelligence, with self-learning, with predictive analysis, are we going to award a machine a Nobel?
Exactly. That's a very good question. I just spoke about that at Google about a week ago. In my author talk there, and you're absolutely right. And there's no people I've talked to in the Swedish Royal Academy circle say, well, Alfred Nobel's will says the prize shall go to the person. But I point out, you know, that's in the singular, right? So they've already ruined that clause because they give it away to three people, and the Peace Prize is given away potentially to thousands of people as it has been in the past. So there's no reason, according, you know, they're very keen on picking and choosing which attributes of Alfred Nobel's will they adhere to. And I think that undermines the integrity, right? If you're just going to pick and choose things, either do it exactly as he said it, which means that you have to give a prize every year to the preceding year's greatest discovery or invention, and to a single person, and that invention has to be provable that it caused the greatest benefit to humanity, which is very hard to do in astrophysics, I think. And I think otherwise you have to admit that his will is going to be malleable, and you're going to adapt it in a way that reflects how science is done now, not in 1895.
Brian Keating, you make a good case for all of this, so best of luck with your book. Brian has written Losing the Nobel Prize, A Story of Cosmology, Ambition, and the Perils of Science's Highest Honor. Thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
It's been a pleasure, guys. Thanks for having me.
Okay,
thanks,
we hope
Brian.
To talk again soon. Thank you, Brian.
Okay.